Late Night Live. Ideas and opinions from around the world.
G'day, gladdies and potties, and why can't I hear myself? Can you hear me, fellas? Okay, I've got nothing in the headphones, but I'll just plough on. First things first, this is the 200th birthday of Lord Alfred Tennyson. He was born in 1809. He died 107 years ago in 1892, which means that the old darling, were he alive today, well, he'd be 200, but he's in fact charging on into the valley of death. And now my knobs are working, if we'll forgive this intimate disclosure. We must dig up the interview I did with Lord Tennyson and run it on Classic. I hope it hasn't gone missing like the one... Anyway, look, talking about classics, I had a couple of classic guests tonight. One of them rejoins the program after a long absence. His name is Howard Goldenberg. He's a Jewish GP, and his Jewishness is significant, as you'll discover. He spends a lot of his time in remote Aboriginal communities. He also writes so beautifully that it makes you want to weep. And then you'll meet a young bloke who's very different in style. He's a young Muslim. His name is Imran Ahmed, and he spreads the message of moderation. Now, my first guest is... I wouldn't describe him as delightful, but certainly forceful. He's a very courageous, independent young bloke. And his name is Anthony Lowenstein. He's a Sydney-based journalist, author and blogger. And he's just been to Gaza to see for himself what the situation is there. Let me remind you that on the 27th of December last year, Israel launched its military attack, and that lasted until the 18th of January this year. The reason for the attack, Israel said, was to stop Hamas rocket attacks on southern Israel and stop the smuggling of arms into Gaza. We all saw on television the devastation that resulted on the most populated strip of land in the world. At least 4,000 homes were destroyed, 400,000 Palestinians made homeless, and over 1,000 were killed. Anthony, you described the Gaza Strip as utterly unlike anywhere you've ever visited. Can you give us a feeling, an idea of what it's like now?
Well, thanks, Phil, for having me on, firstly. What's interesting about Gaza, as soon as you cross the border from Israel, it's a massive warehouse on the Israeli border. You cross, and as soon as you cross, you see massive devastation. There are buildings that have been bombed. I was told by the Israelis just... in January this year during the war, and you sort of cross about 500 metres of no man's land, and you get to the Hamas checkpoint. The Hamas men with their lovely beards talk to you, they ask for your passport, they ask for information about why you're there, and then you're in. And the drive from the border to Gaza City is about 15-20 minutes, and the sense of what you see there is really, on one hand, not utter devastation. There is certain areas which are bombed, which are certain neighbourhoods that have been completely destroyed, but much of Gaza itself is still standing, looking very poor, looking very in difficult straits. Of course, there's a great deal of begging in the streets, but on the one hand, it actually was not as devastated as I expected. On the other hand, most people you speak to there, Gazans, whether they're Hamas, Fatah, whatever they are, they feel like they've been forgotten, because essentially there's been a blockade that's been going for about 3 years now, which has been imposed by the US and Israel, and indeed supported by much of the world, including Australia. And the sense is that people feel like they're not being heard. But at the same time, there was, weirdly enough, some kind of hope. And many people I spoke to, believe it or not, actually talked about a two-state solution, which I was shocked about.
What happened to the hundreds of thousands of Gazans left homeless? What are they doing for shelter?
Well, for the majority of them, and of course I didn't see all of them, but I saw a great deal of them, live under tents. Tents either provided by human rights groups internationally, tents provided by Hamas. Some of them, including the ones I saw, were living in their bombed-out houses in the area called Jabalia, which is very close to the Israeli border. An entire suburb has been completely flattened, so all the buildings have not been repaired. They have not been... the rubble hasn't been removed, mainly because, A, cement's not being allowed in by Israel, although they can allow in a small amount the next couple of weeks. And secondly, people who are living there have retrieved whatever they can, and they're living desperately. You know, some of these people used to have successful businesses. One guy I met used to have six very large Mercedes cars, and he has nothing anymore. He's living with his entire family in one room in a shack, and he feels humiliated.
Well, so humiliation has been the central point in the stuff you've been writing, and let me contextualise it. While the firing of rockets by Hamas into Israel and terrorising civilians is intolerable, one of the things that the Israeli Defence Force does is mete out collective punishment and practice humiliating the Palestinian people. There's one story you tell about a farmer.
Yep. Well, the farmer that I spoke to a number of farmers who also live near the border, told of a story that in early January when the Israelis came, they crossed the border, of course, in the ground invasion, and they destroyed his house without telling him. They just sort of arrived, bulldozed his house, didn't ask him or his family to leave the house before it happened. But then, more ominously and sort of surreally, in fact, he said that a lot of the roots of trees were taken. In other words, the olive trees were, of course, flattened by the bulldozers, but the roots themselves were stolen to be taken back to Israel. And what's strange about this is that when I spent some time a few weeks before Gaza in some West Bank settlements, the illegal settlements near Jerusalem, you often see olive trees that have been planted there by settlers. So these obviously not naturally growing in that particular spot. They've been taken from Palestinian villages or Palestinian towns and removed there. And this, I think, although we can't prove this, of course, that particular place, was what's going on. So in other words, apart from destroying this guy's house, they also had removed the livelihood of his existence and indeed a sycamore tree, which I write about, which his grandfather had slept under, had lived under, had indeed taken shelter from for many, many years, hundred years ago, which no longer exists. And in some ways, these stories, Philip, are just, it's one story. They don't necessarily make up a whole, but you hear these kind of stories time and time and time again across the strip, whether it's people who were affected by the war directly or people who simply living on the streets. I spoke to a number of very, very poor people who, poverty has always existed in the strip, of course, and Hamas, with all its faults, is trying to some extent rectify that issue, although I spoke to a number of Hamas people, and some argue, of course, that for Hamas the situation is quite good. There's a Hamas elite, like there's a Fatah elite, and they're making money off the tunnels, which, of course, are going from Egypt into Israel. And I went very close. You can go up to the tunnels on the Rafah border, which is the Egyptian-Israeli border, and you see the lifeline of Gaza. And what's extraordinary about this is that I expected the shops in Gaza to be empty. I expected them to be not full of any goods, and I'm not minimising the fact that there's massive shortages, but in fact, many of the shops have a lot of products. There is medicine. Now again, it's not to minimise the fact that much is not available, and many doctors and hospitals said that, but the tunnels, it's not because of Israel's largesse, it's because the tunnels are bringing everything in from Egypt.
What, much international aid about the place?
There is some. What was interesting was the most noticeable aid was from Turkey. There are lots of Turkish flags in refugee camps suggesting that they donated tents and other medicines. Ironically, of course, there are a number of Australian government-related projects in Gaza, but the great irony of ironies is that no one's actually going in to monitor them because Gaza is regarded as an enemy entity. So that's a very strange irony. And, of course, there is, to some extent, there's been a number of months ago after the war, there was a big conference to donate billions of dollars of aid to repair Gaza. None of that money has really come in because a lot of that money was supposed to be for rebuilding, for cement, for tools, for the way of life. And the bizarre thing is, of course, because there's been no cement, I spent time with a number of engineers who were building clay houses. They said, we haven't built clay here for decades and decades and decades, but they have no choice.
One of the things we've discussed on the program a while ago was the effect on kids. I understand that you've been able to observe the effects of the war on the children of Gaza.
Well, I did. I mean, I spoke to a number of children and obviously parents of those children. And one of the things that strikes you time and time again, which is reflected in virtually every human rights report that's come out, whether it's Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, or others, is the fact that many children, and the parents told me, confirmed this, actually saw horrific things during the war. They, a number of families who said they had seen children being shot in front of their eyes by the Israeli troops. Some of this, of course, is verifiable, so I should say that. I can't prove anything that I heard. But what's interesting is that every human rights report that's come out has really reported very similar things about exactly the same kind of people, and I didn't meet all these same people, but it's clear, as some listeners may know, that Breaking the Silence, which is an Israeli human rights group, released a report 2 weeks ago, which talked about Israeli troops who had been in Gaza, 30 of them, and talked about some of the kind of abuses that they had seen, and indeed they committed themselves, including using Palestinians as human shields, shooting innocent Palestinians for no particular reason, etc., etc. So this is coming from Israelis, not from just from Palestinians. But the effect on children, and indeed adults, was profound, because people to some extent haven't got a great deal of hope. They look around the political reality, which is dire. They look to, I ask people about Obama, but you ask people about Obama in Gaza, and they say, yes, Obama's much better than Bush. And what's he done for us?
We've got to wrap it, Anthony, but thanks for your time. Anthony Lowenstein, journalist, author, blogger, and an updated version of his book, The Israel Question, will be published next month by Melbourne University Press. This is Late Night Live, and as promised, the rest of the program, you'll meet two extraordinary fellows, Imran Ahmed, a young Muslim, and coming up after a little bit of music, Howard Goldenberg, an elderly GP with an extraordinary story to tell you.